This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Solar World. We're about to speak to Robert Lyden, who's the Executive Vice President and General Manager at Sterling Energy Systems in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to Utopia Media's Solar World.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be there.
Your company just signed a big contract with Southern California Edison to provide solar electricity. Could you tell us the general terms of that agreement?
Yes, generally. It's a 500-megawatt contract, power purchase agreement, for 20 years, and it could be expanded to 850 megawatts. In either case, it's the largest solar power plant in the world, and even at 500 megawatts would generate more power than, according to SCE, our customer, than all of the other U.S. solar power plants combined.
So the structure of this deal essentially is that you're going to produce electricity using solar energy, and you're going to sell that to Southern California Edison, which is going to retail it to its customers.
That's correct. We'll do that actually through a special purpose corporation that we'll have, which will be partial owner. We'll have obviously some other equity investors as participants with us.
Okay, well, let's talk about that just a little bit. What are the investment opportunities for investors who want to do well by doing good here?
Well, there's two kind of investment vehicles, one of which is probably a more likely avenue for individual investors, and that is investment in SES Inc. That's our parent company.
Right. Is that traded?
We are not publicly traded right now. We're it's a privately held things. We do have a number of about 375 shareholders, as a matter of fact.
Right.
They're private placement individuals, high net worth individuals primarily.
Right.
And there's we are still in a position where we are looking for other investors.
How could other potential investors get in touch with you?
The best avenue would be for them to call our offices or email us. The office phone number is area code 602-957-1818, and they could talk to Donna, either Donna or myself in our office. Or if we're not available for some reason, they could also talk to the chairman of our board, David Slauson.
Okay, and if they want to send email, where would they send that?
I would send that to R. Lyden, R-L-I-D-E-N, at sterlingenergy.com, and that's STIRLINGENERGY, all one word.
And if they want to get more information about what you're doing, they can go to the website, which is exactly where?
www.sterlingenergy.com.
Okay. Let's talk about Robert Sterling. On your website, it says that in 1816, which I guess is almost 200 years ago, he essentially had the conceptual breakthrough that enables your technology now.
That's correct. He was a minister, a Scottish minister, that frankly, was losing a lot of his parishioners to accidents involving the steam boilers that were blowing up.
Right.
And at that time, the boiler technology was not what it is today, and it was the subject of many, many accidents. And so what he was looking for was another alternative way of generating motive power, which could run a either a workshop or it could run a power plant, and his idea was to use this external heat type engine. It's really kind of like a heat pump type system.
You right.
Expand and contract gases. The real key to it was not what Dr. Sterling came up with. That worked. It was not very efficient, but it did do the trick of helping to. It didn't blow up.
Right.
Which is good, but at it wasn't until some considerable time later that that other people came up and with ideas for some really key heat exchangers that go along with the Stirling engine that help substantially improve the efficiency.
And the class of machines that we're talking about here essentially are called closed cycle regenerative gas engines. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so what it does is it takes the energy that's instantiated in hot gas, and it uses it to move things, and thereby generate usable energy.
Right. At least in just taking our application where we're using solar heat energy as the heat source for the engine, that heat energy is heating up a gas, a working gas. It's sealed inside the engine.
What kind of gas is that?
We're using hydrogen gas, although you could use helium or nitrogen or air or a variety of other types of gases.
Okay.
Hydrogen's the most efficient.
Right.
And it's heating up the hydrogen gas as the gas is heated. It expands, and it pushes a piston down, and then as it expands, it also cools, and then it goes through these heat exchangers, gets cooled more, and it gets compressed and on the next cycle of the engine. So that this is a four-cylinder engine in which each two cylinders are in pairs that go just back and forth, one going up while the other one's going down.
Right.
And this allows this engine to, or the pistons are connected to a crankshaft that then is connected to the drive shaft on a generator motor.
And how fast do these cylinders go up and down in the inside?
It runs at a constant RPM of about 1,800 RPM. So it's like a little bit more than an idle type rate on an automobile engine. It's a very slow, steady rate.
Okay.
Engine.
And that up and down motion of the cylinders then drives a generator, which creates electricity.
Yes, and it's 480 volt AC power, conditioned and ready to put directly into an electrical circuit on the grid.
Okay, let's talk about the machines that generate that heat. Now that we understand how the heat is converted into electricity, how is incident solar radiation converted into that heat with your technology?
We use a series of mirrors that are attached in a shape like a parabolic bowl or dish.
Right.
We have actually 82 individual mirror facets, each of which is precisely focused, then set and fixed at that focal point, so that it focuses the sun's heat energy into a very even flux onto the top of the engine.
Are those mirrors made out of just sort of the kind you used for makeup, or are they particularly advanced, reflective, highly industrialized kind of mirrors?
Good question. They're basically your same old cosmetic mirror. It's a silvered backed glass.
Right.
It does have a particularly precise radii of curvature. It looks pretty flat to the naked eye, but there's a slight curvature to it.
Right.
It's very precisely prepared so that the surface has no irregularities into it, so you get nice, precise focusing of the thing. But otherwise, it's just like your old everyday glass mirror. We use a backing right now, a metal backing behind the mirror facet, but it could be it could be any of a variety of other materials.
Okay, how do you keep them clean? Do you have somebody in a harness scrolling up and down the face of it, or you hose it off, or protect it otherwise? How do you keep the mirrors from getting dirty?
Good question. The majority of the time, that is like at least 11 times out of every 12 times or something, we wash them about once a month. So about. But 11 times a year, we use a high-pressure spray.
Right.
Spray deionized water.
Okay.
And it's all done from ground level. There is one time just before the start of the summer season when we're getting ready for the peak load that's the most valuable for the utility.
Right.
We'll actually do use some sort of scrubber type system as well.
Okay. Now, so essentially, then the incident solar energy is from all 82 mirrors is focused on the same spot.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, and that, of course, it becomes additive, and it generates what kind of temperatures?
Yeah, we actually focus the sun several thousand times, and so we could generate very, very hot temperatures at the focal point.
Do you want to get the hottest possible temperature, or are there sub-maximal temperatures that are more optimal?
Well, actually, we'd like to get it about as hot as we can handle with the materials,
right,
without melting the materials or something.
Right.
We're using a high temperature steel alloy, an Inconel alloy, for the at the target point to try to protect and get the highest temperature we can. But we actually regulate the flow of hydrogen through the tubes, these Inconel tubes, to take the heat off of the tubes before they get too hot.
And right.
We maintain a constant temperature of about 720 degrees Celsius. That's about 1,300 and some odd degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay. Now, obviously, you're going to want to follow the sun as it apparently moves through the sky. Of course, the Earth's rotating. That's what's doing that.
Right.
Do you have actuators and sensors and whatnot to move the array to keep it facing the sun?
Yes, we have two axis tracking systems, two drive motors. They're little one horsepower motors. Are very, very small, but they do move the dish in the morning from a night stow position, which is kind of face down, facing towards the north, and it goes over, picks up the sun and the low eastern horizon at dawn, and then follows the sun's path throughout the day, and finally ending up at near the western horizon at evening time. And then turns the dish around and puts it back in a night stow position at night. How it finds the sun is really all done by ephemeral data that's programmed into a computer chip so that it knows where the sun is even if the sun is hiding behind a cloud. We do have a closed-loop corrective system in the Logic that does a little bit of fine-tuning to balance the heat and make sure that we're precisely focused on the sun's image. But it's primarily done by just calculating. If you know what the latitude, longitude is, the time of the day, and the day of the year in the Gregorian calendar, you know where the sun should be.
Right. Does it incrementally move, or does it just move a few times during the day? It's constantly moving
bit. It's inching about every 10 seconds.
Okay.
So you know, as you look at it, it just sort of bumps along there, but very, very smooth bumping. But it's constantly sort of...
Okay. Now when the electricity is generated at the site of the array, how does it feed back to either a central point or off into the grid?
Well, what we do is we collect the energy from a number of dishes, say in a cluster of 50 dishes, by connecting them by underground wiring, and then
so they're cables underneath each array.
Yes, yeah, they just collect the energy coming off of each engine
right.
on each dish,
right?
And then that's actually goes through a step-up transformer, just to gain efficiency, so you don't lose as much online
right.
Things, and then moves to another collection point where we collect. The arrays from quite a number of different clusters of 50 dishes each, and then that goes through another step-up transformer and finally gets to the edge of the field where we step it up to 230 kV, 230,000 volts.
Right.
And then transmit that over to the grid line where it goes into a step-up transformer if necessary to get to the final utility grade.
So it goes in at one entry point into the grid off of your solar farm, essentially.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Can you tell us how much one of these arrays costs, or is that proprietary?
Well, that's proprietary. What I can tell you is that the reason that we're going to these large-scale type of arrays, 500 megawatts, is 20,000 dishes.
Right.
Is
20,000, what I've been calling arrays here, these
the 20,000 individual dishes
right.
that make up one power plant,
right.
generating station.
Right.
And the reason that we're going to such large volumes is in order to be able to facilitate the high-volume type of manufacturing efficiencies and automation and so on that is very well established and used very effectively in, say, the automobile industry.
Right.
And we really have what looks like kind of a funny-shaped car. If you take our whole dish engine system that makes up one of these generating units, we have a lot more mirrors than the car has, a lot of glass, so a lot of structural steel.
Right.
One four-cylinder engine with an associated radiator and a generator. And
right, so it's sort of an inside-out car in a way.
Yeah, it really is, and it's a lot simpler, frankly, than today's automobile. You don't have any, you know, suspension system. You don't have any emissions control system.
And who's going to be, who and where will these be manufactured? By whom and where will these be manufactured?
The dish, structural dish components, that is, the whole steel structure that holds the mirrors and makes the dish part of the system, will be fabricated in the Phoenix, Arizona area by Chef Steel, who's one of our partners.
Okay.
And the engines will be fabricated as a number of different sub-suppliers and so on, but they'll be put together by an engine manufacturer that's in the Detroit area. Actually, it's the company is based in the Detroit area, but the engines may be, in fact, fabricated in one of their subsidiary plants that are located in various places around the United States.
So we got a lot of American American jobs are being generated by this, as well as electricity.
No question about it. We estimate that we'll be generating somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 5,000 jobs during the construction phase.
Right.
And about 100 to 200 jobs for operation and support of a 500 megawatt plant, and including the replacement component manufacturing and all of the community support type of things, that amounts to somewhere close to, well, between 350 and 600 ongoing jobs. So at the site and related support.
Okay, where are you going to put this, and how much land is it going to take up?
Well, the actual amount of land that's required will depend on whether we're doing 500 megawatts or 850, but nominally, I think what was in the press release that went out from Southern California Edison is about 4,500 acres. That might be a little bit bigger if we go to the full size, 850 megawatts, and it might be a little less if we're at 500 megawatts. And it'll be in the Mojave Desert area, northeast of L.A. I can't give you the specific site right now because we're still under final negotiations on the acquisition of the land.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up by talking about the implications of this? Start with the amount of pollution that this system generates.
Zero pollution. That's one of the real key things about solar, and particularly with our type of technology. We don't use any sort of polluting types of materials in either the production or storage of heat or in the actual operation, other than there's a little bit of lubricating oil that's sealed in the engines, of course. But
right.
But there's no emissions. There's no exhaust emissions from this. We're not burning
No CO2, no greenhouse gases.
No CO2, no greenhouse gases of any kind. We also use very little water. The only water we use is for washing the mirrors.
Right.
And that's about 14 gallons of water per mirror per washing. So even in a big field like this, we're using a very, very small fraction of the amount of water that's used by a typical power generating plant.
How much do you have to pay for the fuel?
Zero.
When do you expect that the fuel will run out?
Oh, probably well past my lifetime. Actually, if the fuel begins to run out, the least we have to worry about is the economics of the solar power plant. That means we're in deep trouble.
And how susceptible is the fuel to variations in governments in far parts of the world?
That's the nice thing about it. It's nobody's yet been able to figure out how to shut off the sun, thank goodness, and it's readily available to everybody in a very ubiquitous way.
Okay, now, you're going to be building 20,000 of these dishes. What's that going to do for the unit cost for the next customer who wants to buy some?
We expect that the cost will continue to go down. By going into this 20,000 unit build, we're able to offer to SCE really a pretty economical cost of units. We will have already gotten down the cost curve, in other words, quite a bit in the building of these first 20,000 dishes. But as with any sort of production manufacturing things, the cost will just continue to go down as we get more and more units out there.
Okay. What's the expected lifetime of one of these units or the whole farm?
At least 40 years. We have dishes that have been operating in the desert for over 20 years now, and they're still operating with the same efficiency, even with the same mirrors and so on that were there 20 years ago, and they're still giving the same optical efficiency. The engines are still running at the same efficiency. So it's a very durable system. Now, we'll have to obviously replace seals and other things in the engine from time to time, but having done that, that's like the routine maintenance you do on a car or a bus or a truck or something.
Do a rough calculation about at current prices of electricity produced overall, how long will it take for one of these systems to pay for itself?
We're talking about a number of a small number of years. It's not 40 years or anything. It's a very small fraction.
Pretty much single digit number of years.
Yes, it is.
And so essentially, for the 30 years after that, it's going to be producing electricity for the cost of oiling the sprockets.
Yeah, actually, the way it works a little bit, Mark, is the financing will probably be 15 to 20 year bank financing.
Right.
Once that bank financing is paid off, then we're really able to generate electricity at the cost of the operating and maintenance expenses, which is a penny and a half per kilowatt hour.
Okay. How much, what proportion of the usable solar-drenched area in the Mojave Desert is your array going to take, is the whole farm going to take up? And essentially, how much more space with the same solar parameters is available for an expansion of what you're doing?
Oh, we use just a small dot in the desert. It's incredible. The amount of space that's available in just the Mojave Desert, we could put enough dishes up to power the entire nation. In fact, a calculation done by the Department of Energy is that if we took an area that was about 100 miles by 100 miles, that's a lot of area, but that's still only a fraction of the Mojave Desert.
Right.
We could generate as much energy as used for all fossil fuel purposes and consumption in the United States. That means for all transportation uses as well as all electric generation. So
if we're not going to talk about it, but if the people working on plug-in hybrid electric vehicles wanted to plug their vehicles into grids that are powered by Stirling engines, they wouldn't have to use much. And if the batteries got better, they could use less and less gasoline.
Well, that's correct. And ultimately, we think that we could use the electricity, this low-cost electricity from these amortized solar plants, to produce hydrogen.
Right.
And then the hydrogen, which from water, by just electrolyzing water. And if you did that, then the hydrogen could be transported around the country, and it could be used in fuel cells and cars. It could be used in regular internal combustion engines. It could be used in regular conventional power plants in lieu of natural gas or coal.
So this is a pretty bright day for renewable energy.
It really is. We see it as really kind of a breakthrough. It's been a long time coming. This is sort of like the instant stardom that somebody has been working for 30 years.
Right.
We've been working in our company since 1996, but the technology has been under development. This dish technology has been under development since the mid-80s. And it's been a lot of hard work to get it to the point where we can now see how to deploy this in very economical large quantities, but very economical terms.
And you call it economical terms. Robert Stirling in 1816 called his invention the economizer.
Very good.
Okay, good. I want to thank you for bringing the 19th century to life in the 21st, and for all the work you've done. And I hope we can talk again as the system's deployed, and talk more about how it's working.
Look forward to it.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.